Welcome to another episode of the Growth Focus Podcast, where we bring together tech leaders from all across the globe to help share their insights and their expertise so that we can all grow together. My name is Gary Lafter, your host, and I am the founder and CEO of the Authority Accelerator, where we drive revenue for tech companies by making sure that our tech leaders are seen as authorities in their industry rather than just another expert, so that clients choose them as opposed to them doing the chasing. And I couldn't be more pleased this episode to have our guest, Matt Selby from Urban Free. And we're going to be talking about long sales cycles. We're going to talk about building client trust and data-driven decision-making, amongst other things. So make sure you stick around for the whole podcast to get these insights. So without further ado, Matt, it's an absolute pleasure having you here to join us today. Why don't we start off by sharing about who you are, what is it that you do, and a little bit about your journey.
Sure. Well, first of all, Gary, thank you very much indeed for having me on the podcast. I think it's going to be a great conversation. You can never have too many Brits in the same room, or even if that room happens to be virtual. So, my career is fairly brief. Most of it was spent in the oil and gas industry, and then I did a few other things and morphed into software. As part of the oil and gas experience, we lived overseas in Asia and South America, and obviously various places in Europe. And that's very, very helpful if you want to think about how you approach different businesses with different cultural types. So now we're in the sunny state of Oregon, and I started a company called Oberon 3 about 14, 15 years ago now. It's a SaaS company, software as a service, and it delivers real-time actionable feedback via the cell phone. So in effect, it's like a sexy digital comment card. And I'm sure we're going to get into who uses it and why is it useful a little bit later on.
Yeah, we absolutely will. So listen, this is the whole point of having a great podcast is, and having great guests like you, is the personalization. So what I'd really like to know, why don't you spend some time just sharing with us what inspired your pivot? You know, you obviously had a great career in the oil and gas, but what was that pivot that made you go from where you were to where you are today?
Sure. So there's probably a number of different reasons. The first is that whilst oil and gas, I think, is fine, after a while, you spend a lot of time traveling and moving, and that isn't quite so good when you've got a family. The second thing, we were in Houston, and I'm not a massive fan of Houston, so we wanted to get out of that and go somewhere different, and we wanted to go to the Pacific Northwest. So there's a geographical nudge. But the biggest one, of course, is that during my years doing that, I'd actually run a couple of businesses within the company that I was working for. And that's a really profitable, in every sense, experience, because it nudged me into thinking about, well, would you like to have your own business? What was it going to be like to actually be the captain of your own ship rather than report to other people? So I knew I wanted to start a business. And one of those businesses actually had been software. This is even within the oil company. And it seemed to me that if you're going to start a business, one of the key things you want to do is to find something where the industry that you're selling to is traditional, somewhat stuck in the mud, a little bit narrow-minded, perhaps. That's the first thing. The second thing is the SaaS model, I think, is enormously attractive because you can start a SaaS business for very, very little money. And if you crack it, that is, if you get recurring revenue, the recurring revenue tends to be at a higher margin. And you spend quite a bit on the acquisition cost, but if you can crack it, it's the gift that keeps on giving. Now, the final thing was, okay, so what do you want to do? My last real job was I was the brands manager of an oil company here in the States. And one of the things that we noticed was that the defection rate that all of your audience, I'm sure, worries about, it is double digit. So this was in the gasoline side. That is, the average gas company loses over 10% of its business every year. And that not maybe a full defection, but it's a partial defection. Now, I don't know about you, Gary. I don't know much about your business, but I could not afford to lose 10% of my customers every year. So it seemed to me that if there were a way to be able to understand at the point of experience, that is, at the point at which somebody is buying or consuming your services, that they were unhappy, and an alert could be sent to the business, and the business could take action, you've now got the recipe for reducing that defection by basically going in, acknowledging the customer's unhappy, and actually doing something about it. So that was the impetus of the business. And I mentioned that traditional feedback mechanisms, they're good, but they needed to be shaken up. So let me give you a kind of a quick example that sort of tipped me over the edge. I ride a motorcycle, and the good news is for us Brits, it was a Triumph. And when I bought the bike, I was called up probably 5 weeks later. And the conversation goes like this. They said, oh, this is a Triumph here. We want to find out a little bit more about your experience buying the bike. I said, you know, fine, how about it? First question was, how polite was the sales assistant that helped you 5 weeks ago? Now, I don't know about you, Gary, but I can barely remember the names of my children. I certainly can't remember what I had for breakfast. So you're expecting me somehow to go back in time and think about giving you an objective rating for some kid who sold me a bike. And it seemed to me that the methods that were being used like that were asinine. And if there were a way we could deliver this digital comment card in real time, you could fulfill somebody's need and solve a real problem. And the good news, as you know, is that defection can be measured. So if I can, through this service, reduce your defection by 5%, the economics are very, very powerful. So anyway, long story short, finished with the oil business, wanted to start something else, I've done a little bit of entrepreneurship before. And then it was really about finding the geography and finding the niche.
Well, let's talk about that niche then, because I know when you and I have talked before, finding the niche doesn't necessarily come naturally. You know, we don't necessarily hit it straight away right from the very beginning. So let's explore that a little bit. Let's talk about potentially getting the wrong niche, and what do we have to do about it once we get the wrong niche, about pivoting quickly, failing fast, and learning from it?
Yeah, so I would love to tell you, and let's pretend you were an investor. Then what I wouldn't be telling you is that we pivoted at all, and clearly I was Nostradamus and I thought about this, and clearly we never got anything wrong. But that would be that would be incorrect. We have made many, many mistakes along the way and pivoted enormously. Let me give you one where we thought we had cracked it. So when we started the company, we targeted it at restaurants because restaurants have a double-digit problem, literally a double-digit problem. The first is that if they lose customers, they lose a lot of customers. So the defection rate is probably between 15 and 17%, something like that. Huge numbers. They also have the double whammy, which is if I defect, I may well end up on Yelp and complain, and so trash the brand. So we thought restaurants, they are ideal for us, and there's a lot of them. Here's where we screwed up. The average restaurant in this country is actually owned by a mom and pop. You know, we think about Denny's and we think about these other chains, but that's the bad news. They're owned by small companies. And these organizations, these mom and pop shops, are very, very frugal. They're going to throw away $50 worth of lettuce, yet balk at spending $30 on ours. So from our point of view, it was absolutely the wrong market to go after. And then we sort of lucked into others, which was the government. So my message to anyone listening to this is, if you do find that it's not working, you know, whilst people like Churchill might say, well, you've got to keep on going, keep on going, I would say fail fast, really fail quickly, and say, this is what we've learned. Now let's take it to someone else. And in our particular case, we sort of lucked in the government. So, Gary, my advice would be, whilst it's advantageous to fail fast and recognize that the market you've selected, however proud you are of that, shouldn't be your own personal hobby horse. And you go on to something else. Now, my advice, however, is I've seen companies, particularly smaller startup companies, act like kindergarten kids playing soccer, which is the ball comes out on the field and there's this swarm of kids go around the ball and somebody kicks the ball and then they move. It's a bit like a Monty Python sketch. So I wouldn't do that either. I would stand back and think objectively about, what is it you are solving for this particular market, and is it sustainable, and can you generate cash from it? Now, I know that's easy for one to say, and at the beginning when you're starting a company, maybe your mentality is, well, if I kind of sprinkle myself a bit over here and sprinkle myself a bit over there, or you say, well, you know, I'm from the oil business, you've got to drill a lot of holes before, you know, you get the gusher. My advice is you just don't have the resources to do that. So pick something, look at it, fail quickly, review, and then pick something else.
Yeah, I think that's tremendous advice. And one of the things which I want to just pull out from that and add to that is, like you said, just because, you know, marketing 101 tells you, to hear a lot of these gurus will say, find your niche, find someone with a problem, solve the problem. To a degree, that's true. Mm-hmm. But if they can't afford to pay you because the problem's so bad or whatever it is, that then it doesn't matter. You're not being a charity. You're a business that needs to grow. And you maybe there are other people that can help them. You're just not going to be that person. Right. You're not going to be that company that helps them find the companies or find where the money is. So they have the problem and the funds to pay you, you know, to solve that solution. And I think that's a key thing there for everyone. So that being said, you ended up predominantly now with government. You chose the government niche. Let's talk about, first and foremost, why. What was it that you found, for sake of another word, attractive with working with the government?
It's a great question. And again, Gary, I'd love to proclaim that I had this vision a few years ago to say government, that's it. In fact, it was probably the opposite, because if you listen to kind of entrepreneurial podcasts or read the press, government are usually slated as being quite hard to deal with, bureaucracy, timescales, and so on and so forth. We stumbled into it. We stumbled into it because we noticed that when driving on the freeways here, you have great rest areas, and these rest areas are throughout the country. And we noticed that one of them, that is here in Oregon, they used a paper-based comment card system to elicit feedback about cleanliness and vending machines and everything else. So we said, on the off chance, let's approach these people and say, we'll replace this for you. We had a free pilot program, and it was a big success. And as a result of that, we've now got 12 state contracts with the DOT who run the rest areas. We have parks contracts. We have municipality contracts, all doing the same thing. And if you remember what I said at the beginning, and I know you did this well in your previous life, is you take something that is generally thought of as either antiquated or where an organization has been doing it for years and years and years and years. And if you can come in and improve that, usually at a fraction of the cost, you are going to, particularly for government contracts, look like a hero. You're going to look like the 7th Cavalry coming over the hill, because you're solving a problem in real time in a much more efficient way than they possibly could, and they're going to look good. So we got into government arena. And if you think about it, relative to the private sector, the government is, one, not going to run out of money, we hope. They're good for the cash. They're not going to get, you're not going to have a bad debt. The second thing that's attractive is that they tend to have longer-term contracts. So I'm going to sign up. I believe cash is king. And I will reduce my margin if the length of the contract is greater, because I want to have the knowledge that my cash is going to be sufficient, and I know what it's going to be. And the third one, which is I hadn't really thought about, is in the government sector, people tend to stay much longer in a role than they would in the private sector. Now, I don't know about you, but we've been kicked out of companies because there's been a change in management. The new boss comes in, the very first thing he does is trash whatever his predecessor did, and you're shown the door very, very quickly. With the government, that's not the case. People tend to stay longer, which means you have a huge opportunity to develop stickiness, a longer-term relationship. So for those three reasons, which is they don't necessarily have up-to-date technology, and therefore you look like a hero, longer-term contracts with assured cash, and the fact that people in there for a longer period of time, makes it a very, very attractive market. And that's why we spend 80% of our marketing dollars going after the government. Now, there are some peculiarities, which is they have a hard and fast budget. You've got to go through more paperwork than you would think would be normal. And things take a long time, and they're quite unpredictable. And they may be even more so with, you know, the incoming administration who are thinking about, you know, cutting back on federal programs. But for us, it's been fantastic. Highly encourage your audience to think about whether or not they have something that is different enough to be able to fairly quickly change for the better an existing government process. And this, in the SaaS world, this market is called GovTech, G-O-V-T-E-C-H. Have a look at it, and you'll see a lot of innovation in that arena.
Yeah, that's some fantastic nuggets in there. I mean, whether you knew it or not, there was just so much you threw in there. So I just want to dive back in and pick up some of those nuggets. So, you know, absolutely. Let's take your third example there. You know, they do change, especially, you know, predominantly people listening here are going to be in the tech industry. Mm-hmm. And you're quite right. All it takes is a new CSO, a new CISO that comes in. And your tech is no longer flavor of the month anymore. You know, they want to bring their crew in. They want to bring, and it is a double-edged sword because that's how businesses are grown. When somebody moves, if you've got a relationship with that person, you move with them. But it also, on the other side, means someone's getting chopped that's out of their control. Whereas the government, you know, I didn't even think about that, about the government. They tend to stay there for a much, much longer time. I've got people working in the government, from very good friends of mine, especially in Colorado, and they've been there 25, 26 years. You know, they're very high up in their industry, in their departments, and they're not moving. So it's a very, very good point. But I want to really talk about, Matt, long sales cycles. You say, you know, there's definitely some quirks you've got to deal with. One, some people might be saying here, do you know what? It's long sales cycles. That's what is the challenge of dealing with government. What insights could you share with that?
Gary, what I would advise those folk who are listening to the podcast is with the government, the good news is it's predictable. That is, you know when the budget begins, you know when the budget ends. The second thing is you can ask for what their budget is. So you have a sense of the big, the small. The third thing is that they tend to be quite transparent. That is, they'll say, well, we're thinking about this, we're thinking about that. So you know that you've got a certain laboratory amount of money that they could potentially target. The big thing that we found that works with the government, the first is this is going to sound a bit cheesy, but well, what the hell, is we just spoke about the longevity of people within certain government positions, and they tend to stay there. So one tactic we've used is, let's just say, Gary, you worked in South Carolina. I'd say, hey, Gary, your colleagues in North Carolina are using our product. We tend to think that the government folk in similar positions are actually quite, not incestuous, but they know each other. And so they're very curious as to understand if one of their contemporaries is doing something that's a little bit more innovative. So that's one cheesy thing. The other thing that we found is that they do tend to be reasonably numerate. So we built for us an ROI calculator that basically says, look, give us your numbers and we'll calculate for you in real time in Excel how much you will be saving, which means that they've got a ready-made template to take it up the channel to say, this is how I'm justifying my budget. So with government, as with your other, you know, any other client, help them make the sale up, which all inevitably they'll have to do. And if you can do that, then you reduce the variety, the uncertainty in the sales cycle to your benefit. And the final one that I would say is socialize. There are, you know, one thing I like about the States, there are many things I like about the States, is that it's such a huge market. So even though you and I have just talked about the government as though it's this one big entity, what I'd recommend is niche down and go after a department or a service that, because the States is so big, it's going to be more than enough to fill your belly. So go after something small and then expand.
Yeah, great piece of advice there. Great. And so I want to dial a little bit back because you mentioned something and I want to sort of dive a little bit deeper into that. And that is, you know, building trust with new contacts. You know, it's hard enough. People here out there will be listening to this and going, do you know what? It's hard enough for us trying to break into other institutions, but something as entrenched as the government is, how do you get in there and start building trust with the right type of people?
So I think there's a couple of things. The first is that they do tend to know each other. So if you can say, I'm working with Gary, who's also in the state of Florida, we work with the Department of Transportation, but Gary, you're in charge of Parks and Recs. I think it would be very interesting for you to be able to talk with X in Florida. So the first one is you play the geographical, you must know this guy card. The second one is you play the, well, your colleague, your opposite number in the same, in a different state is doing this, and therefore I'm sure you'd want to know about it. The third one that we do is to, we do quite a lot of outreach using personalization. So we would send to a prospect, let's just say they're in the state of Washington, they run the parks, state of parks, parks department. We would then send them perhaps a personalized video with a personalized ROI model and a personalized walkthrough of the program so that one, they think they're special. Two, you actually tell them what it does and how it applies to them without being too helicopterish. You actually bring it down and make sure that you give them numbers. I think people's attention span these days is so short. And remember that, you know, here in the States, it's what, 3.8% national unemployment, something like that. There's just not enough bodies, spare bodies, to review emails without any purpose. So you've really got to pique their interest. And as I say, either of those three tactics we will probably use. But the big thing also that we've started to do more of is trade shows. Because at a trade show, whilst it may be expensive as an acquisition tool, think about their need state. Someone's walking around, they've got a couple of days off from work, and therefore they're not looking at their phone every 5 minutes, and you do have an opportunity to engage. So we've used those in some form or fashion in order to start the process. But once you have them, what we do is to update them in fairly reasonable, yes, I think reasonable intervals as to what we're doing and what the data means. One of the big things that we found is, again, going back to the unemployment rate, is that they want to know what the feedback data, in our case, is telling them. So we issue a report saying, hey, Gary, for the month of June, this is what's happened. So you're feeding them the analysis that, frankly, they should be doing in order just to make sure that they become aware of what's going on, that we're top of mind, and if they're called for it, they have a ready-made package to pass upstairs.
You know, I love that. And again, I want to expand this, unwrap this a little bit, because you've mentioned it a couple of times in different guises now, but this is giving them the numbers, letting them know what they don't know, but giving them the tools so you're enabling them to buy.
Yep.
We always seem to think there's a sales process and then a buying process, but in the real world, it isn't. There's a sales process and then a sales process and a sales process and a buying process and a buying process and the buying process. Yep. And they're so disjointed most of the time. Yep. But like you say, your methodology there of going in and say, look, let me teach you how to buy. Let me show you what you need and let me give you the tools that will help you be the champion, be the buyer, no matter how many times. Let's delve a little bit more into that, you know, in the real world sense.
Sure. So we've done a couple of things. The first is, this is predominantly with the government. We've done it elsewhere. We will develop a case study. So the case study will be about the effect of implementing a feedback program like ours in a state or an airport or something. So the first thing that we'll do is to say, when this technology is employed, this is what really happened. So one, it gives you credibility because you obviously, frankly, you're naming names. And the second thing is that they've got some idea of the type of clients that have already bought. Again, just going back to the government, and I know we don't want this to dominate it, but if making the first sale is the hardest, when you've made the first sale, other government agencies will assume that the first agency has taken all the risk and they've done a really good job. And therefore, it's much easier for them because somebody else has put a tick in the box to give you that authority. So you're right. Case study is one. We also provide is a simple ROI model using an Excel calculator that we built. And it's a very simple tool because all it's doing is to show you what you're currently spending now versus what you will be spending in the future and other benefits. And obviously, when we place this, the what you're going to be spending in the future is less. And we do this in the form of a waterfall chart, which you may be familiar with. It basically breaks down the benefits into savings buckets and outputs it as a chart. And I'm very happy to share this with you and anybody else who wants it. The benefit of all of this is that it gives the recipient one, a model they can play with and put in their own data rather than some fabricated, no disrespect to salesmen, but you know, salesmen tend to be somewhat more, enthusiastic with their projections and so on. So it allows the person to use their own numbers. The numbers are fairly credible because we built it up using our data. And the biggest one, of course, is it allows them to sell upwards. So I think unless you're talking to the CEO, which in the government you never will, you're talking to someone at a level where they will have to get approval. So arm them with everything, with the toolkit, the spears, the guns, and the grenades to be able to sell and make sure that it's gold, not glitter. I've seen too much crap in my time and people selling me stuff where it's a bright, shiny object. But when, you know, I don't want to mix metaphors here, but it's a bit like a McDonald's Happy Meal. It looks kind of good on the plate, but there's really nothing to it when you start playing, you know, playing with it with your fork. So make sure it's something substantial.
Right. So that's a really, really good point. You know, as I said, and I love the fact that the metaphor you've said away, make sure it's not glitter, make sure it is a good solid gold. So they are getting what they, you know, something good and valuable. And that builds long term. That builds long LTVs with your clients, you know, and they'll stay with you, government or not government. Something you and I talked about, which I'm looking forward to talking about very briefly here, is grit. Entrepreneurial grit, you know, is something that you and I have talked about before, you know, and it is vital in today's world to deal with the mountains of crap that we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis, you know. But we have seen, you know, we've talked about this before, we have seen attitudes change with regards to the working mentality. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So I think one of the things that, let's kind of define terms. I would say grit for me is kind of a mix of persistence, tenacity, and, you know, by God, I'm gonna do this, you know, try again. Mm-hmm. Now, conversely, if you listen to Freakonomics, one theme is, well, if you fail quickly. So I'm not going to mix two, because one is about looking at target markets and failing and adjusting. Grit is really persistence. It's dogged persistence, because nowadays, as I say, the unemployment rate is low. There aren't enough people working. People's attention span is getting limited because they're being bombarded with so much stuff. So you need to have enough grit to be able to persist and keep going, despite all of the challenges that that's going to be thrown at your way. I don't really have any number one rule over this. Over and above, it took us, I don't know, at least 12 months, probably 15 months, to get to a point where we knew that the software actually solved a big enough problem for a large enough market. And we could have given up earlier on. After the first few deliberations. The other thing that's going to happen is, perhaps this is grit plus thick skin. You're going to get knocked a lot. I suspect, like a prospective actor or an aspiring actor, you go to a lot of auditions and get kicked out. But the market is so big, this is partly a numbers game. And therefore, your grit calculations should take into account that you do need to kiss a lot of babies and shake a lot of hands before you will get to someone that actually really has the time and understands what you're doing. And luck has part of it. But, you know, what did Gary Player say? The more I practice, the luckier I become. So grit, I think, is enormously powerful. And that's easy for me to say with gray hair, but it's an enormously powerful virtue to have that shouldn't be underestimated.
No, absolutely. And I totally agree with you. As I said, you know, everyone thinks entrepreneurs, well, not everybody thinks, but there is this vision of entrepreneurship. I'll start here and I'll end up here. And that's the journey it's going to take. But we all know, and everyone listening knows, this is, it just does this. It's just every day there's a new challenge, a new corner that we have to deal with. But having a purpose and having a vision, but allowing yourself to fail, I think there's themselves to fail and then start worrying about it. And then, yeah, you can change course direction. Doesn't mean you failed. It's just that you just changed it into a different destination. You know, you're still going to go flying. You're still going to land where in a new place where you want to go, but it might not be the original place. But having that grit to go through and push through, no matter what anyone says or what hitches, is a vital thing. So listen, I've got one last thing, Matt, to ask you, and it's a bit of a loaded question. And is that, knowing what you now know, you know, from all your corporate experience in oil and gas to where you are today, the ups and downs, the challenges that you've had and the successes, what is the one piece of advice you would give to your younger self, your younger Matt Selby? Listen, you need to know this for the future. What would that be?
I think for me, it's the ability to stand back and think more carefully with more measure when something doesn't go right, or when an idea has been proposed that sounds good on paper. I have had far too many instances where someone has said, wouldn't it be cool if X could do Y? Now, coolness is interesting, and when you're 25 and a software developer, that's what gets you out of bed. But that doesn't pay the bills. So one of the things that I would say to my former self is, before you undertake the resources, the planning, and the investment to change, either change product features, change industry, change customers, really stand back and think about it and say, what does this solve? What does it really solve? There's a difference between solving a problem and being cool. The second thing is, assuming that it does solve something, for how many people does it solve? Because if it isn't big enough, it's not going to be worth the resource time. And thirdly, Gary, what I would absolutely enforce is calculating in advance the size of the market. There's no point putting something new in place. There's no point in changing niche unless you know how big it is going to be and whether you've got a high likelihood of being able to conquer it, or at the very least getting a sizable niche enough to defend. So what I would encourage my Matt of youth, of my youth, to think about is to stand back and objectively review and take your time. So rather than act like an unguided missile, you act with a lot more precision and a lot more definition and therefore a lot more certainty, and end up with fewer gray hairs than I have.
Well, that's a fantastic piece of advice, you know, and that's brought us to a fantastic end to our conversation. I can't believe the time has gone by so quickly. So Matt, if people want to get hold of you, what's the best way that they can do that?
Sure. So my email is mselby, Selby, you can see on the screen here, at Oberon3. If you know your Shakespeare, you'll know Oberon, Oberon3. The technology is called Opinionator, so you can go onto the website and have a look and just contact me that way, and would be delighted to talk about feedback and very, very happy to give any advice, solicited or not, on what you like.
Well, I'll make sure your contact details are in the show notes as well, so people can get hold of you from there on in. So, Matt, all that remains is me to thank you very much from the bottom of my heart. It's been an absolute pleasure and honor having you here. You've shared some great insights, and thank you very much for your time today.
Very good, Gary. I'd love to be on the show. Many thanks for putting it on, and looking forward to hearing your future guest.
I'm sure we will. We'll stay in touch. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us again for such a great period. So until next time, please. subscribe, but you share the messages that you've heard today. Who else do you know that can benefit from what Matt has shared with us today? So the more we share, the more we can all grow together. So until the next time, thank you, Matt. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us. We'll see you all soon. Bye-bye.